So this is Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. I am Jim Grant. With me, as always, is the great deputy editor of Grant's, Evan Lorenz. And Henry French is at the controls. He's our sound engineer par excellence. And joining us today, Evan, is Daniel Paris, who was in the dividend business and who has written a most fluently written book on the topic called The Ownership Dividend. And we'll talk to Dan in just one moment. But you and Dan, Evan, have something in common. You know that? You married a Russian wife, and as did Dan. In a moment, we're going to talk about that odd coincidence right here on our podcast. But first, I want to set the stage for a discussion of income with a couple of observations and thoughts. One is a quotation from someone who is accounted perhaps America's most brilliant, certainly the cleverest, and perhaps the most influential economist, Irving Fisher, from yesteryear, lived about a century ago. And he's the author of something called The Theory of Interest. And here is what he said in 1930, quote, "Capital wealth is merely the means to the end called income," close quote. So I have thought about this a lot. We wrote this, I quoted this more than once. But every day I walk into the office and am accosted with Mr. Market telling us that there's nothing in that. There's no truth in what Fisher. Look, Evan, here's a question for you. What is the current market cap as of 3 minutes ago of the crypto universe?
$2.9 trillion?
Trillion. What is the dividend yield on that accumulation of hope?
Well, in terms of human imagination, it's quite big. But in terms of actual cash, I think it's about zero.
No tax problems then with that. Evan, what approximately, I know this is a reckoning because Bloomberg is not quickly, what is the current value of fixed income securities marked to yield less than nothing?
$330 billion, or about one-tenth of the market cap of crypto.
Right. So we are looking at more than $3 trillion of things that yield nothing or less than nothing. Is my math correct?
Yeah.
So $3 trillion is a lot of money, even when you say it fast. And with that, I'm going to introduce today's guest. Now, Daniel Paris is a PhD and a CFA and a senior vice president and senior portfolio manager and head of Strategic Value Dividend Group at Federated Hermes in Pittsburgh. He is a scholar of Russia and of Russian history, and I happen to have at my fingertips the title of his PhD thesis. Ready?
Yeah.
The Soviet League of the Militant Godless in the 1920s and 1930s. That's the subject. I'm not sure that it's the title, but it's the subject. Okay, so Daniel Paris is a man of parts, and he has written The Ownership Dividend, and the subtitle is The Coming Paradigm Shift in the U.S. Stock Market. So, Daniel, welcome to Current Yield.
Jim, thank you so much for having me. Evan, thank you so much for having me on the show.
The name of our show, Daniel, is perfectly in sync with the spirit and the letter of your recent book. And I wanted to ask you first about this misdirected $3 trillion. What are these investors thinking, Daniel Paris?
Yeah, I struggle also to get inside their heads, other than, you know, kind of animal spirits. But the nature of an investment without an income stream strikes both of us as odd. I think I use a even longer quote from Irving Fisher from his book, in 1906, that makes the same point, that an asset without an income stream is very, very hard to work with other than in pure speculation. And I really do think that it's an environment, crypto has come out of an environment in which over the last 15 years, interest rates, risk rates, the cash nexus, what I refer to as the cash nexus for the stock market, has been kind of broken or attenuated so much that you have widespread acceptance of assets without income streams. And that strikes you and me as odd. It obviously doesn't strike a lot of other people as odd. And so the book is an exploration of, well, how did something that, you know, by any chapter one of any finance book or any even remotely fluent experience in history of investing, such an anomalous situation came about where you could have the U.S. stock market, which is my area of focus, stripped of its income for all intents and purposes, and this entire other asset class is opening up without any income stream. How could that possibly have happened? How did we get to this environment? And that's really what the ownership dividend takes up. It's a little more focused on the stock market, but it takes up that broad issue and suggests that the causes for that move away from the cash nexus have largely exhausted themselves, and that we are on the verge, in one form or another, of the return of the cash nexus for investing. Listen, there'll always be speculations. There have always been, there always will be, buy low, sell high, repeat quickly, get rich schemes which have no long-term cash flow implication. That's to be expected in any sort of open society, and even more so in closed societies. But that the U.S. stock market on the whole would have been stripped of its income, and your corner of the bailiwick, the fixed income market, would have been had income suppressed for so many years. I think that that is unusual, anomalous, and it's coming to an end.
When?
Well, I got very, very lucky, Jim and Evan, on the publication date. The book was published on January 31st. It was moved up from February 14th, from Valentine's Day to January 31st. And on February 1st, or thereabouts, Meta announced the dividend. So I've been joking, making the rounds with the joke that that Mark Zuckerberg got an advanced copy, read it very quickly, and convinced his board to institute a dividend all within 24 hours. And a few days later, Salesforce did the same thing. So I can't give you the dates. Obviously, for the stock market, I can't. But for the fixed income market and the money funds market, a non-zero number came back with a vengeance. And now you have fixed income instruments, government securities, and money funds paying numbers that you can start to analyze, 4, 5, 6% cash returns.
So what do they think of next, Dan?
What do they think of next? An income stream with an income stream. That's just amazing. But the U.S. stock market has not responded. The U.S. stock market is still in the cashless frenzy. So, the book came out on January 31st, 2024. The most that I'm willing to say is the next few years, over the next decade, that the return to a normal, or what I would consider normal, but other people would say higher payout ratio and dividend yield for the U.S. stock market, so that investors can engage in what I would consider a more proper exercise of capital allocation between different asset classes based on different income streams and the growth rate, that is equity growth rate of those income streams versus maybe flat income streams that are higher in the capital structure, and be able to engage in what I consider a more normal exercise in asset allocation. For the last 15 years prior to the return of the cash nexus, it's hard for me to even describe what asset allocation was, because no assets had income streams.
You know, in the days of yore, I'm thinking now of Great Britain and the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries, people would talk about wealth in terms of annual income. So in a Jane Austen novel, you read that such and such character is worth £5,000.
Mr. Bingley was worth £5,000.
Yeah, that meant, ladies and gentlemen, a year, which, by the way, was a quite extraordinary amount of wealth in those days. But people would express it as Irving Fisher, I think, would have wanted them to express it. Here's a question for you, Dan Paris. Has the secular shift to not just government-issued fiat currencies, but also the systematic central bank suppression of interest rates, is there a monetary cause of the fetish for capital appreciation?
Yeah, I was on another discussion, another podcast, and the book is about really the stock market and declining. I refer to them as risk rates. Other people would refer to them as interest rates. And the author took me to task for not having a whole chapter on the fiscal policy and specifically monetary policy. And the truth is, I don't. It's a kind of an obvious suspect. It's the obvious kind of gorilla in the middle of the room. I do talk at length. The theme running through the book is what happens, what has happened to human behavior when interest rates go down for 40 years, and what happens in particular when that stops. But in terms of the institutions causing interest rates to go down for 40 years and any ulterior agendas that they may clearly do have, which is kind of behind your question, I will defer to you on that. I'm just looking at the implication on the stock market. Clearly, it was ended up in the same place, meaning it did push people into riskier assets, yeah. And that is and currently everyone seems to be very happy with that environment.
Yes,
you can object to financial repression and fiscal policy that is not to your liking. But to judge by the harvested capital gains mechanism that the U.S. stock market has become, as opposed to an income platform, it's not currently illegal, immoral, unethical to harvest a capital gain being generated by some of these background forces. I grant you that. I'm just saying it's historically anomalous, and I think that the pendulum is going to swing back more to the middle.
I was interested in a detail in your book where you talk about the reinvestment fallacy of stock dividends. And I'm thinking about the contrast with the bond market, in which the reinvestment of coupon income is in fact a thing. In Marty Leibowitz's Inside the Yield book, I'm certain of this, he wrote that the reinvestment of coupon income can generate as much as 40% of total return in a time of rising interest rates. And so this speaks to the double-sided effect of rising rates in a bond market. Yes, prices go down, but your reinvestment income tends to rise, and it can be a quite important. Okay, that's the bond market. Dan Paris, please explain to us why in the stock market, the idea that dividend total return is dependent upon an investor's patience and thrift in reinvesting the dividend income, why that is a fallacy.
Yeah, pretty simple, actually. And it's just the way we count. Total return is calculated on a daily basis, any change in the price of an asset plus the income stream. And then the next day you start all over. So let's take an example of grandma. Grandma owns 1,000 shares of Verizon. It's all she owns. There are two grandmas. One takes the dividend, the other reinvests the dividend. Verizon has a singular total return. It is the change in the price and the income payment received four times a year. So the investment has had the exact same total return. The amount in the account will vary differently because one of the grandmas took the income and one of the grandmas reinvested it. But the total return of the actual investment is identical. So I constantly am challenged by investors who look at a price chart and say, listen, that stock's kind of flattish. Why do you own that? And I said, that's a price chart. Total return is the following, which is counted correctly and is obviously has a slope and up and to the right because the dividend yield that's distributed, which comes out of the share price, is included in the total return. And so most people say, the total return of the dividends is only because of reinvestment. I said, I'm sorry, that's just not how we calculate. The account value does matter if you take money out, if you have a monthly distribution, right. If you put money in, of course the account value will change. But the return of an independent is independent of, the return of an investment is independent of whether the investor is taking the distributions or leaving them in the account.
Okay, so it's a question of counting and counting protocol rather than something perhaps more substantive.
Bringing us back to the present, according to Bank of America, the dividend yield on the S&P 500, which I think is around 1.5%, is near an all-time low. You just pointed out that Meta recently initiated a dividend. What's going to cause the other 499 stocks in the S&P 500 to friend paying back shareholders cash?
Yeah, so just on Meta, again, it's kind of a point. Announced a dividend. They also, the same day, they announced, as part of the same press release, a share buyback that was worth $50 billion. The dividend was worth $5 billion. So a 10-to-1 ratio, and the yield of Meta at the time was half a percent. So 50 basis points, de minimis from an investment perspective. So it's more at the symbolic level. The yield of the S&P 500, around 1.5%. The all-time low is actually, due to the tech bubble, is 1.1%, I believe, in March of 2000, but close enough. I, as a business owner investing through the stock market, would look for a more normal yield given reasonable growth rates of the income stream of 3 or 4, 5%. Obviously, it's nowhere near those levels. And it's going to be a while and a combination of both interest rates or risk rates, what I refer to as risk rates, continuing to remain at normal levels, not high levels. Interest rates are not at high levels. I'm sure you'll agree with that. They're at normal levels. Payout ratios moving up. And the return of the cash nexus as a sensibility. And I think that's the part that really is the answer to your question, Evan, is that I think that the stocks are going to have to compete on the basis of cash along with other asset classes. The same way that an investor currently can look at cash, fixed income, government securities, private investments, real estate. They all have some sort of cash flow to help measure them. And then there's the U.S. stock market, where someone, everyone just leaves their senses aside and says, well, I'm just going to buy low, sell high, repeat frequently. I'm not going to do any math based on the cash stream, the income stream. And I think that over time, the boards of the companies are going to come to the same conclusion that Facebook's or Meta's did, that they need to at least have some skin in the game in terms of a cash income stream. They're a very successful business. As for the other, you know, it's more like there is a section of the U.S. stock market that pays a meaty dividend, kind of 150 companies or so. That's this pool of the pond or the corner of the pond where I fish in my day job. It's really a matter of the other, call it 300, 350, that either have no dividends or very, very modest dividends that don't really amount to much. And I think just over in the fullness of time, meaning it took 40 years to get to this current cashless state. From 1980-ish, 1981-ish, 1982, the book has a chapter on what the catalysts were that started this decline, up until 2021, 2022, et cetera. It's going to take a couple years for, I think, that pendulum to swing back to a more normal relationship. And the companies are simply going to come to the conclusion that the Meta board and Salesforce board did, that This is how you know normal investments work. And over time, I think that will play out. I am working, my next kind of social media posted piece is entitled Who's Next? And there's some obvious suspects. There are also some obvious companies among the FANGs and Mag 7 who can't afford, even despite their size, can't afford or shouldn't even pay a dividend because frankly, they don't have the cash flow for it, believe it or not.
Going into your day job for a second. In the last two or so years, the Fed has increased rates a little over 500 basis points. And investing in that 150 stocks that are priced off of a dividend yield, I can't imagine has been the easiest thing. Like a real estate investment trust is often priced to a yield. And when competitive yields go up, the stock price has to go down in order to offer a still competitive yield to money market mutual funds and other alternatives. Can you talk to us what the experience has been like and kind of the process has been like of being a dividend investor in a world where the levels of rates is changing?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. I refer to it as being a dividend investor in a stock market. For the first 20 years, it was hard because no one is focused on dividends and most of the stock market's moving away from dividends. And that kind of creates a framework of constraints on the opportunity set. The last year or two, we are facing genuine competitive issues from other assets. And the argument comes back to the same argument that we had when we initiated the suite of products 22 years ago, and that is the dividend growth side of the equation. That is, yes, cash now has a cash return, that is money funds. Fixed income instruments, government and non-government have 4%, 5%, 6% numbers, but they are flat over time. The reason to own equity in a normal environment is for the growth in the income as well as the income. Not you are further down the capital ladder, you take more risk, but in return you get a growth in the income stream. So we're kind of back to basics, but you are right. We got used to having, as a dividend manager in a stock market, almost a monopoly over the last 15 years for investors seeking income solutions because they really couldn't get it anywhere else. The good news is client perspective is we no longer have a monopoly. Clients have access to a variety of non-equity income streams that they didn't have access to a couple years ago. That creates competitive issues for us. So we're back to chapter one, which is, you know, why would you own equity in the first place? And that is for the growth in the income stream, not just the income stream.
I want to digress just a moment, Dan, and ask you about your earlier life as a student of Russia. And this bears a little bit on the financial situation. One of your propositions towards the end of your book was the ending of the so-called global neoliberal order. So explain this, and I'm going to ask, Evan is also, gets a lot of this at home, but I'm going to ask you this. It's a question that many people ask, and it must betray as much ignorance as curiosity. And here it is. All right. So Russia, when you think of Russia, I don't think first of Vladimir Putin. I think of being that kind of a cultivated chap. I think of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky and a little bit of Shostakovich too. But I think of Russia as something formerly kind of one of the wonders of the civilized world. And here we are today. So tell me, if you would please, how Russia figures into your concept of the end of the global neoliberal order. Is there a paradox in Russia doing what it is doing? And how does this bear on the price of the S&P 500 adjusted for dividends?
The topic of the paradox of Russia and the West, it's called, literally called the Russia and the West debate, is the topic of my next book, maybe more of a retirement project. It's going to take a while. But the environment, the cashless environment that we currently found ourselves in up from 1980 to 1980 to 2020, Russia does play a role in that. 1979, Deng Xiaoping comes to power in China, begins the process of liberalizing China, which creates supply chain reality 40 years later. Margaret Thatcher elected in 1979, Ronald Reagan elected in 1980. Interest rates for the 10-year, I know you look at other parts of the curve, but for us what matters is the 10-year peak in 1981. Share buybacks are legalized by the safe harbor provision in the SEC rules in 1982. The Soviet Union starts to collapse in the 80s, doesn't do it quite on cue in 1980 or 1981 or 1979, but it does begin to collapse. And what you have in the beginning of that period is really the ushering in of globalization, a liberal world order, deregulation, global supply chain, and the march of capital, unfettered march of capital around the world. It doesn't matter which administration, Republican and Democratic, are in agreement. And it works for 40 years, more or less, where you have, we ended up deindustrializing this country because it was cheaper to do so, to import deflation from Asian markets, outsource all of our manufacturing there. The stock market with buybacks gets very clever. You have the financialization of returns. You go from earnings to EBITDA. You know all the tricks of the trade, Jim. And you have this period, which frankly, most people, everyone in the industry, Jim, I won't give away your age, but you're one of a handful of people who remember the before times, but most of us operating in this industry came up in this environment in which this seemed like the norm. I, as a historian, came into the profession, quickly memorized the rules right around 2000, transitioning from a Russian academic career. Quickly memorized the rules, got my CFA in 3 years, very unpleasant experience, and went about in a new profession using those rules. But as a historian, it bubbled up with me. You can take the boy out of history, you can't take the history out of the boy. I kept on asking, well, how do we get to this moment? It seems so abnormal. Particularly, it's abnormal if you consider chapter one of every finance textbook that we're still using that uses cash flows to value assets. And then the period appears to come to an end. And you can see it quite dramatically. You see inklings of it in 2016 with Brexit and Donald Trump's election. You see it with a greater vengeance in 2020 with COVID and China ending our assumption that a globalized, just-in-time globalized supply chain is a super idea and the kind of end-all and be-all. 2021, you have the attempted coup in the United States orchestrated by Trump, which really challenges the notion of a political consensus in this country. In 2022, you have Russia invading Ukraine, which is, again, a kind of a violation of the consensus that the global neoliberal order is here to stay and has prevailed, a refutation of Francis Fukuyama's famous The End of History in 1989 article and book. And interest rates bottom. And that's kind of the theme that runs through the thread that links everything in the book together is a political scientist or geopolitical person could see all of those things. But in our corner of the world, Jim and Evan, the financial part, kind of the glue holding this all together is interest rates going down for 40 years. And I could retitle the book, What Happens When Interest Rates Stop Going Down? But environmentally, you also had the end of the global neoliberal order, and Russia played its role of refuting the global neoliberal order, as has China and all the other factors, and Donald Trump, all the other factors that we mentioned. But in the background, you have interest rates reaching a rock bottom on the 10-year, I think in September of 2020. And so now all of the circumstances, both environmental and direct, which supported a 40-year paradigm, I believe, have come to an end. The tricky part is, with the exception of a few wizened old souls, and I would argue a few historians, most people who've come up in this paradigm are perfectly comfortable with it. They've known no other. Stock market keeps going up. So why, you know, what's the problem here? Buybacks are fine. They are under the illusion that a buyback is the same as a dividend. They've been taught that in from the University of Chicago. If the University of Chicago says it, it must be true.
So taking all this together, what is an investor to do with this information? If we're coming to the end of one regime and starting a new regime, what should an investor allocate? How should an investor position oneself? How should an investor protect oneself? What does it mean for the stock market?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the $64,000 question. So the contours of the new paradigm are not clear yet. Fair enough. We've had a 40-year paradigm, and there's a lot of uncertainty, particularly on the geopolitical side. So a lot of this is not clear. But one thing is clear. Interest rates are not going back to zero. The 10-year is not going back to 60 basis points. I also draw a distinction between risk rates and interest rates because there are so many external factors affecting interest rates that I kind of separate them into risk rates. And I'll simply say, I don't know where interest rates are going, but I do know that risk rates are not going back to September 2020 levels. What that means is, again, for the asset allocators, they can already see it. It's that you go back to chapter one of your finance textbook and you can begin to choose among asset classes according to your risk and return characteristics based on cash returns. Within the equity market, that hasn't happened yet. I'm a little early. I got lucky with Facebook and, you know, 24 hours after the book comes out. But as a practical matter, the return of risk rates means two things. And the return of the cash nexus and the return of normal risk rates means two things. First of all, Facebook and Salesforce are not going to be the first and only companies. A lot of other companies are going to be introducing or taking up their dividends. The second is that any investment structure that is really predicated on declining interest rates. And boy, there were a lot of investment products, SPACs, among others, that came along in recent years that were predicated on ultra low interest rates. They're simply not going to be viable investments.
I'm a little bit familiar with SPACs, but how are they predicated on low interest rates? I mean, for our listeners who are not familiar, a SPAC is a special purpose acquisition company. They're basically raise cash from investors and try to buy a business later. They take the cash that they raise from investors and put them usually in short-term treasuries. So they actually benefit when rates are a little bit higher because they have a little bit of income. How are SPACs specifically predicated on low interest rates?
Yeah, I simply mean it as a form of an investment in which you're not tagging it to a long-term income stream because there's no business in it. You're just handing money over to somebody else to invest.
There are trillions of dollars worth of investments or asset classes that are so predicated. I mean, private equity is predicated on falling interest rates and the access to leverage.
Private equity is going to have they are in the process of having real issues. Cliff Asness, I'm sure you're familiar with his work. And others are calling into question how private equity works when money actually costs something and when there's a return of a cash nexus. And I think you're going to see a great deal more of that, investments that have gotten by without a cash nexus are called into question going forward.
Does a bear market, is that a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for a change in regime? Are you going to flourish more when stocks are going down? And
yeah, I'm not. It's a fair question. It's a fair question. And it's an assumption. I'm not really a bear market person. It's one of the scenarios I do outline.
We've been misinformed here.
It's one of the scenarios. You can get there the hard way, or you can get there the easier way. The easier way is through higher dividend payout ratios, and the harder way is by changing the share price.
Well, I think the very easy and the very desirable way this might happen is for many, many more hundreds of thousands of people to go out and get a copy of Dan Peres' new book called The Ownership Dividend, The Coming Paradigm Shift in the U.S. Stock Market. I'm going to venture my test of when your prediction, or your call, is going to be perfectly validated. Is everybody listening to this? Very important. Okay, here it is. When you plunk yourself down in a dental chair and the hygienist said, I hear that GM's going to raise a dividend. That's the moment. And you'll let us know when that happens to you, right, Dan?
Absolutely.
Thank you for being with us. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us. Oh, Evan, I forgot to the commercial. You ready?
Yeah.
Subscribe to Grant's Interest Rate Observer.
I think that's a great commercial.
Okay, good. Done. Thank you. Talk to you next time. This is Jim Grant on behalf of Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air.